bacteria break out of the bowel and into the abdominal cavity and then the blood vessels. The process starts at this certain point on the abdomen, near the appendix, because the abdominal wall is very close to the intestine here. Putrefaction can begin elsewhere, but only with good reason. For example, if a body is lying across a heating pipe, or part of it is in direct sunlight. Wherever it begins, by the time the green blotch is visible on the skin, then the bacteria are running riot inside the body. The blood vessels provide easy channels for the bacteria to spread, causing the hemoglobin there to decompose. Visible result? The extraordinary and beautiful fern-like patterns of the veins closest to the surface becomes clearly etched on the skin as though tattooed in brown. It is often evident on the arms and thighs. I think the police officers were beginning to realize now that this was no David Attenborough documentary. But like every death process, this rather beautiful stage is temporary. Gradually the pattern is lost as the skin blisters into red and brown fluid. As the blisters burst, the skin sloughs off. One waste product of all this bacterial activity is gas, and so now the body begins to swell. First, the genitals become bloated, followed by the face, abdomen and breasts. Then eyes and tongue protrude as bloody liquid is forced up from the lungs, leaking from nose and mouth. The face with its popping eyes and tongue has a look of amazement. Those officers who could look at the screen, and many chose not to, stared back at the body I showed them with equal amazement. Swelling bodies at this stage of decomposition become so dark that anyone finding one can wrongly assume a skinny Caucasian was in life an overweight black man. Flies have a role to play in putrefaction by feasting and laying their eggs, which turn into maggots with voracious appetites. Animals, domestic and wild, may also make an important contribution to bodily breakdown. Outside, there are rats and foxes, and inside, well, yes, a starving dog which finds itself locked in the house after a death will probably eat its owner to survive. Within about a week of death, depending as usual on the weather and microenvironment, body cavities will burst and tissues will start to liquefy. Within about a month, the soft tissues are all liquid, and these will drain off into the ground. The usual order of decomposition is first the intestines, stomach, liver, blood and heart, then the lungs and air passages, next the brain, then the kidneys and bladder, finally the muscles. The prostate, the uterus, the tendons and the ligaments are relatively resistant to putrefaction and may not break down for months to leave the skeleton stripped. I didn't show any pictures of this final part of the process. They looked as though they'd seen enough. A much more unusual form of decomposition in this country is mummification. Mummified bodies are brown and dry. The skin is drawn tightly over the skeleton so it looks shriveled and tough like leather. This process dries the tissues, hardening them in a way that prevents putrefaction. It usually requires hot, desert-like conditions. Bodies buried in the sands of Egypt may even mummify spontaneously. In the UK, mummification can happen if a thin person, the thin are more likely to cool and desiccate quickly, dies in a very dry and drafty place, an attic or chimney, for instance. It's rare to find a mummified body now, but not so long ago they were encountered relatively often. Anyone here seen a mummified body outside the British Museum? I asked my audience. A few raised their hands. One of the older officers said, "Baby, been hidden in the attic, and not yesterday either. Years and years ago, probably during the war," they said, "because it happened a lot then." "Was it a newborn?" I asked. He nodded. I had actually recently seen a mummified newborn myself, and the circumstances had been the same. The bodies of newborn babies are relatively sterile, which makes them less susceptible to putrefaction and more likely to mummify. Those babies were generally born in secret to single mothers in the days when this was truly shameful. Either they were born dead, or they died at birth as the mother struggled to cope alone, or they were actually killed, but in many cases, burial was apparently not an option, and so the body would be hidden under the floorboards or in the attic. As social attitudes to birth outside marriage changed, these discoveries decreased. But in the 1980s, they still sometimes happened when old ladies died and young couples bought their houses for renovation, to find, in the loft, the tragic, long-hidden, mummified corpse of a tiny baby. there are a few examples of adult homicides revealed years later by the discovery of a mummified body. Most famous is a case in Wales where a strangled woman was hidden in a cupboard for years while her family continued to claim her pension. Once completely dried, a mummified body can last a long time, but eventually mold forms and the dried tissues gradually become powdery and disintegrate. The mummy very often attracts rodents, beetles and moths too. However, if it is recovered in time, it can very faithfully reveal through preserved bruises, abrasions or other injuries the cause of death. The third process of decomposition is adipocere, a rare chemical change in the body's saturated fat, which hydrolyzes it, stiffening and swelling it into a waxy compound, a bit like soap. It's sometimes called corpse wax or the wax of graveyards. Basically, the body, or part of it, is preserved looking as though it is a waxwork. In the UK, the process of adipocere formation takes about 6 months, although I've heard of a case just 3 weeks after death that presumably was aided by the sun's heat and the warmth of maggot infestation. Adipocere requires damp conditions. In its early stages, when the fat is hydrolyzed into a greasy semi-fluid, the rancid smell is terrible. But as the process progresses, the fat becomes brittle and paler, and when the adipocere is fully formed, it's grey and firm. The phenomenon of adipocere has been documented for many years, and it can last literally centuries. Otzi, the Neolithic hunter, known as the Glacier Man, whose body is on display in Bolzano in the Italian Dolomites, was probably at least partly preserved this way. In the 18th century, excavations at the Cimetière des Innocents in Paris allegedly yielded tons of adipocere, and it was promptly put to use by the city's soap and candle makers. There were some famous cases in the 1970s from Australia where the process perfectly preserved the form, if not the contents, of divers' bodies found about a year after they drowned due to equipment failure as they explored a deep freshwater lake. On occasions, adipocere has revealed a cause of death, perfectly reproducing injuries like bullet holes or preserving the fat in certain organs. In general, it's more commonly found in women, the well-nourished and the obese, but conditions have to be right. Usually the body must have been submerged in water anaerobically or buried in a damp grave, especially if there is no coffin, and especially if the deceased is wearing natural and not synthetic fibres. Its formation can be influenced by the season, the depth of the grave, coffin composition, the soil, and the local insect activity. These three processes of decomposition, putrefaction, mummification and adipocere, are not mutually exclusive. All three could, in theory, be found in different areas of the same body, although that would be extraordinary as each requires such different conditions. But two processes have been found together, and putrefaction is always one of them. Although it is common now to short-circuit the natural rotting processes I have described by cremation, the traditional place for human remains in this country is the cemetery. Burial tends to delay decomposition. In fact, a body above ground is said to decompose at least 4 times faster than one buried. Underground, it probably takes 2 years for the soft tissues to disappear completely. Tendons, ligaments, hair and nails will be identifiable for some time after that. In about 5 years, the bones are bare and disarticulated, but there are often fragments of cartilage, and if I use a high-speed saw to cut the bones of bodies that have been exhumed after 5 years, there is a wisp of smoke caused by scorched protein still in the marrow and the smell of burning organic matter, something I can also expect from the bones of the recently dead. The human skeleton is the last part of the body to return to the earth, which of course can take a very long time. Hominid bones more than 2 million years old have been found in dry parts of the world. Unless preserved anaerobically in a bog, the damp UK climate does not keep bones so well, and eventually all bones must decompose. Wet soils that hold water hasten this by leaching the calcium and other minerals away. As the bone becomes more porous, the process of disintegration is helped by bacteria, fungi, and even plants thrusting their roots inside the cracks and crevices and breaking up the bone more, as well as by gnawing animals. Throughout their careers, pathologists are approached by the police to examine bones. I asked the attendees if anyone had submitted found bones to a pathologist, and two people put up their hands. Usually, just one bone is found, sometimes a collection, and they are nearly always from animals, but not always. All pathologists have files labelled old bones, and every attempt is made to identify these finds. Some bones, like the pelvis or the skull, tell us at a glance whether its owner was male or female. Other bones, and particularly teeth, can tell us the age of the deceased if they were very young or very old. Otherwise, judging age from a skeleton is not a precise science. For the most part, our old bones files remain mysterious. Our main task is to date the bones and discover whether this death, possibly a criminal death, occurred in the last 60 or 70 years, in which case the killer might still be alive. Dating is a specialist skill. Carbon-14 dating only works to a very long timescale, but the atomic bombs of the 1940s, with their release of strontium-90 into the atmosphere, mean it is relatively easy to discover whether bones pre- or post-date these explosions. If they predate the atomic era, the police are seldom interested, although archaeologists might be. At the end of the talk, most of the officers made a dash for the bar. There was an orchestra of cigarette lighters clicking outside the door. One detective did approach me, however. He was the older man who had been involved with the case of the mummified baby. "Thanks for that, Doc," he said. "I've been haunted by that baby, and by another one, a body which had been sitting in his armchair for almost a year when we found him. I dream about them sometimes. But when you talk about the science of it, well, that made me feel a bit better. I even found I could look at the pictures you showed us today." This was a rare example of an officer of that era admitting to vulnerabilities, and his words stayed with me. I resolved to redouble my efforts to talk during postmortems. I should not just say whatever came into my head, but present the body in a detached, scientific way, which would help onlookers quash the very unscientific emotions they might be feeling. Chapter 12. Very shortly after that talk came my first defence case. So far, I'd only ever been called to a death by the police or the coroner. That meant I was, almost automatically, adopted as an expert witness for the prosecution if charges and a court case followed. Sometimes the pathologist report alone will satisfy the court. Sometimes a court appearance to answer questions is required. The most searching questions, of course, come from the defence barrister. The defence team will usually call a forensic pathologist too, and they probably will ask for a second post-mortem. On occasions, when a whole group of people is accused of the crime, there may be more defence teams ordering a third, a fourth, and even more post-mortems. In these rare cases, all the defence pathologists might perform their post-mortems consecutively, but more usually together, observing each other's work, clustering around the body like moths around a lamp. Then, if we go to the pub afterwards, it looks like a pathology convention. Each pathologist will write a report for the prosecution or for one of the defendants. Each report will be used as evidence. Each pathologist may be called as an expert witness. You might assume pathology is such a precise science that all reports on the same body must be identical. This is not the case. Wounds and injuries recorded identically may be interpreted differently. Interpretation can be influenced by many things, especially the information supplied concerning a case. The more information there is, the less likely that conclusions may be erroneous. So, as the pathologist on call one night, I might be summoned to the scene of a crime by the police and subsequently write a detached, scientific report based on all the evidence at my disposal. This would be used by the Crown Prosecution Service in deciding whether or not to prosecute the alleged killer. I'd probably then have to give my evidence in court for the prosecution. However, if I'd just come off duty when the police's call came, one of my colleagues would attend the scene instead. But a few weeks later, I might nevertheless find myself working on the same case for the other side after a call from the defendant's solicitor. At the very least, defense lawyers require corroboration of the first pathologist's findings and report. But some defense teams are hoping for more than that. They would like their pathologist to find an error in the original report, which is rare. But still they hope for information which might help exonerate their client. They at least expect a wide-ranging review of alternative explanations or interpretations of the findings and facts. Defence reports are a normal part of a forensic pathologist's workload, but it takes a while for defence lawyers to learn a newcomer's name. So no defence case came my way for some time. I wasn't sorry. I know how hard it can be to carry out a post-mortem on a body already examined by another pathologist. I mean, how technically difficult. There will be an inevitable degree of deterioration, whether the body has been frozen or just kept refrigerated. Further bruising may appear, and wounds may change size. Organs are occasionally absent when they have been submitted for another expert opinion, and tissues have usually been sent away for analysis. However, all the information the later pathologist needs should be available, whether these are found in colleagues' notes or in the scene of crime pictures, reports, or tissue samples. There is another, more personal reason why defence postmortems can be a challenge for newcomers trying to make their way in the world of experienced forensic pathologists. That's the fear of taking an opposing view. Our court system thrives on these differences, but they do nothing for relationships within the profession, particularly if you are just a newcomer facing one of the giants of pathology. Before accepting my first defence case, I checked with trepidation the identity of the prosecution's pathologist. I really hoped I wouldn't find myself reviewing the work of, and perhaps differing in opinion from, some highly esteemed older colleague. To my relief, I learned that the prosecutor's pathologist was one of my contemporaries. So I went to the mortuary to examine the wounds a 17-year-old boy had confessed to inflicting on his father. There were 27 injuries, all of them to the face and head. The skull was broken and the brain extensively injured. The boy's defence team had hoped to persuade the prosecutors that their client was mentally ill, but they had got nowhere and now a murder trial was scheduled at the Old Bailey. The lad's statement was contradicted by the findings of the first pathologist. He said he'd only struck about 4 blows while his father slept in bed. The pathologist insisted there had been more than 20. When I carried out the second post-mortem, I could not fault the prosecution pathologist's report, which accurately described the father's wounds. However, their varied nature raised some questions. In a youthful and enthusiastic quest for truth, I set about making a replica of the crowbar the boy had used, except that my crowbar was made of foam. I asked how tall the defendant was and used photos of the scene to stand at approximately the height and angle he had stood to his father. I then spent a long time bashing a pillow with the crowbar. The pillow was standing in for the father's head. After considerable study, I was able to prove that the lateral motion of the blows would have caused the weapon to rotate on impact and to bounce. I wrote, "The multiplicity of injuries can be accounted for by bounce of the end of the crowbar. The post-mortem appearances are entirely consistent with your client's assertion that he struck his father 4 or 5 times." But my Simpsonian deductions never saw the light of day. A head scan of the man proved that he had been severely brain damaged in a car accident several years earlier. The plea of guilty to manslaughter with diminished responsibility was now accepted by the prosecution, and the boy's trial was withdrawn from the Old Bailey's list. No courage was required to contradict the findings of the prosecution's pathologist for that case. But beyond cowardice or careerism is a deeper problem for both defence and prosecution pathologist. Neither party can ever, should ever, admit to being wrong. It is acceptable to admit that there may be other possible conclusions, but in the absence of any new evidence, the pathologist should be sure enough of his or her view to stick to it. It was alarming to understand at the beginning of my career that the pathologist is assumed to be right, whichever side he is working for. The day I became a fully qualified forensic pathologist was the day I turned from a not very sure trainee who still probably had a thing or two to learn into an expert who can never put a foot wrong, allegedly. So if you have ever thrilled to the transformation of the insignificant Clark Kent into Superman's invincibility, imagine what a disconcerting experience this must have been for Kent himself. Certainly, I have found the cloak of invincibility placed upon me a heavy burden. But why is this? Why must I now always be right when it is the human condition to be wrong sometimes? Answer: because the adversarial nature of our criminal justice system has no room for perhaps, or maybe, or possibly. Even though I was determined in many areas of my life to follow the lines of Pope my father had given me when I was a young man and speak, though sure, with seeming diffidence, The fact was that my job did require me to speak, though sure, with complete confidence. Any wavering, and defendants might be sent down for crimes they did not commit, or freed when they were guilty. The greatest test of sureness comes in the witness box. Court cases, especially at the Old Bailey, which almost reeks of seriousness and importance, can be highly intimidating affairs. I knew that long before I experienced it at first hand. The collapse of one famous case because the prosecution's forensic pathologist had committed a minor error was a national news story shortly before I qualified. That pathologist's long and distinguished career ended somewhere close to humiliation, not because his small error was even relevant to the trial, and I fear not because the defendant was innocent, but because an aggressive defense barrister had exposed a small oversight and used it to undermine the pathologist's competence in the eyes of the jury. This was disturbing, doubly so when Ian West created his own version of the entire cross-examination for us in the pub, playing both the insinuating barrister and the hapless pathologist for his transfixed but rather glum colleagues. I found myself recalling this cautionary tale during my first major dust-up in court. I had been summoned by the police to a homicide and, as the pathologist at the scene, I was a witness for the prosecution. The defense ordered a second post-mortem from one of my former professors. He gave a different cause of death. The defending barrister only had to glance at my callow young face and compare it with that of the venerable professor to know his best line of attack. The exchange, recreated here from memory and not transcript, went something like this. QC, Dr. Shepherd, let's be clear here. I am sure it will be of great interest and significance to members of the jury. Can you tell me how long you have actually been practicing as a forensic pathologist? Me, well, my first actual case was QC. By practicing, I of course mean since the completion of your traineeship. Me, 2 years. QC, 2 years? I see. Are you familiar with a professor of forensic pathology who is also giving evidence at this trial? Me. Yes, I am. QC. Really? How do you know him? Me. He was my professor. QC. Ah, I see. He taught you. Well, Dr. Shepherd, you will then be aware that he has been a practicing forensic pathologist for 40 years. Me. I imagine something of that order. QC, I can assure you that he has been practicing for 40 years. He taught you 2 years ago, and he feels the cause of death you have given is incorrect. Are you sure you have the knowledge and experience to contradict him? Me, takes a large gulp. I've examined the case fully and, I do not wish to, revise my opinion. QC, are you sure about that? You are absolutely sure you know better than your eminent professor? Me, naturally I respect my colleague's, opinion, but mine is different. He did, train me in how to, form opinions. QC? And you are not disconcerted that you have formed an opinion at such variance from the professor you claim to respect so much? Me, no. QC, well, Dr. Shepherd, I admire your hubris, shakes head with an air of tragedy and turns to the jury. Members of the jury, you will, of course, want to come to your own conclusions about Dr. Shepherd's knowledge and experience, or maybe the lack of it. Ouch. But I don't think my professor had a much easier time giving his evidence. In fact, he was forced to accept that I could be correct. Of course, there was a great deal more evidence beyond the pathology of the case, as the judge reminded the jury during his summing up. They then found the defendant guilty. I really felt myself to be under pressure giving evidence in that case, pressure to give way on my view of the truth. Afterwards, I reviewed my findings and conclusions, and I was proud that I had stuck to my interpretation of events. Despite the battering I had received, I was still sure my interpretation was correct. As a result, I convinced myself that the truth was always so clear and that I would always be able to hold on to it so easily, despite attempts to push me this way or that. I still did have a lot to learn. Chapter 13. My children were now at school, but it was well known that I was always disappearing early from the pub after work to take care of them, sometimes even dragging myself away from one of Ian's spellbinding bar soliloquies, because the nanny was going home and Jen was busy at work. My colleagues got into the habit of saying, whenever a case concerning children came into the office, "Dick loves children, give that one to Dick." As if there was any similarity between helping a child of my own with reading homework and examining someone else's dead child. No, the truth was that many people avoided child cases if they could. It did not take me long to learn why. For there is nothing more likely to bring great joy to the private life of the forensic pathologist as a new baby, and nothing so likely to bring great misery to his professional life. Fact. It is quite easy to kill a baby, especially a newborn, without anyone being able to prove it. Fact. Sometimes it looks as though someone has killed a baby when the death is entirely natural. A baby case came in, everyone looked at me, and I soon found myself at a mortuary on the edge of London. The deceased was a newborn girl, found in a black bin bag, washed up at the edge of a lake at a beauty spot. The umbilical cord and placenta were still attached. My examination told me that the baby had certainly been born at full term. She was fully developed, covered in the waxy vernix of the newborn, weighed over 7 pounds, and seemed to have been entirely healthy with no anatomical abnormalities or diseases that could have caused her to die. The police explained that the mother had been easily located. She was insisting that the baby had been stillborn. The police doubted her word. They wanted to charge her. In fact, they wanted to charge her not with infanticide, but with murder. And so we found ourselves in the middle of a really difficult area of both the law and pathology. No wonder the office had been so pleased to hand me this case. Infanticide is manslaughter, and so carries a far lighter sentence than murder. It was introduced in 1922 for the prosecution of mothers who killed newborns under 35 days old. Back then, killing a baby was not considered such a terrible offence as killing an adult. It was believed that no baby could suffer like an adult victim, and no baby would be missed like an adult member of the family. And it was well understood that one possible motive was shame at illegitimacy. We might discount this thinking today, but one important aspect of the 1922 Act has endured. The law recognised that there could be a disturbance of a mother's mind which can result from giving birth, something which today we call postnatal depression, or its even more serious sister, puerperal psychosis. This view was retained by a new Infanticide Act in 1938. From then until now, a mother who kills a baby under 12 months old can be charged with infanticide if it can be shown that the balance of mind is disturbed by the effects of childbirth or lactation. The reform of this law has been debated many times. The Royal College of Psychiatrists recently suggested the definition of infanticide should be broadened to recognise that a baby's birth may have created overwhelming stress, for instance, the stress of an extra member of the household where the family is struggling in poverty. Others thought that infanticide was a charge that should equally apply to fathers, and some that it should apply where the victim was under 2 years old, not 1 year. Some pointed to a lack of medical evidence to justify the reference to breastfeeding affecting the balance of a mother's mind. In fact, after reviewing all these suggestions, amendments have been minimal. But the unchanging law masks changing attitudes, including the recognition that children and babies have rights. As I examined that baby found at the lakeside, the first question I had to ask myself was not whether this was murder or manslaughter, but whether the baby had died at all. Because a baby who has never lived cannot die, nor be killed. And, in the legal sense, a child in the womb has not lived. Anti-abortionists may disagree, but that is the current practicality of the law. The underlying question for the pathologist in such circumstances is, when is a person not a person? And this is important because a person has rights, legal rights to inheritance or title, and human rights. Kill a person and you can be charged with murder or manslaughter, but not if the person never actually lived. Under English law, a dead newborn is assumed to have been stillborn. If murder or manslaughter is suspected, it is up to the pathologist for the prosecution to prove that the baby lived long enough to establish a separate existence. One breath is all it takes, or a movement, or a pulsation of the umbilical cord which indicates a heartbeat, and the baby must be completely out of the mother's body. A baby born head first, as most are, can theoretically take breaths, but still die before the rest of the body is free of the mother. In that case, there has been no separate existence, and the baby cannot have been killed. A baby who has died in the womb in the last day or so of the pregnancy will show the early signs of decomposition, and these are distinctive. For instance, the color of a dead Caucasian child will probably be pinky brown. If the baby has been dead for a longer period, diagnosis is even easier. The skull may have collapsed, and the skull bones might be overlapping, for instance. But if the baby died less than a day before birth, or, much more commonly, during the process of birth, there is, of course, no decomposition. If there has been resuscitation, mouth-to-mouth or chest compression, the effects can be marked on a tiny body, and this can confuse things still further. A final problem is that the bodies of newborn babies who are killed or born dead are, for complex psychological reasons, often concealed. By the time they are found and the pathologist gets to work, it can be impossible to establish the cause of death, let alone whether the baby ever had a separate existence. This little girl in the bin bag had been found soon enough to prevent decomposition and too late for resuscitation, so her body was unmarked. So now I had to try to establish whether she had actually breathed in this world or not. I did carry out the centuries-old flotation test, knowing that it had really lost credibility, but fearing I would be criticised if I did not. The belief that if the lungs of a dead newborn float, then the baby must have breathed and had a separate existence, has been proven a myth. A lung that sinks when placed in water does point to the possibility that the baby has been stillborn, because it suggests that the baby did not breathe sufficiently to expand the lungs. But the opposite is even less likely to be true. If the lung floats, that does not mean the child must have breathed spontaneously. It is now known that the lungs of many stillborn babies will float, particularly where there are gases due to early decomposition if the baby has died a day or two before birth. I also examined microscopically the lung's tiny air sacs, the alveoli. For what it was worth, the child's lungs floated. Macroscopic and microscopic appearances did strongly suggest that there had been a period of separate existence. My next job was to read the statements I had been given and see how they related to the baby I had examined. The key statement came from a barman who lived and worked at the same hotel as the baby's 21-year-old mother. It began, "When Mandy came to work at the hotel as assistant manager, she seemed all right, except that I only had to look at her to think she was pregnant. I have two sisters with children, and she certainly looked pregnant to me. This was common knowledge among the bar staff, but Mandy always denied it. The staff all stayed in one part of the hotel, and the barman's room was by the fire escape at the back. He woke very early one morning to the sound of a baby crying outside his door. He looked out of his window and saw the back of Mandy, maybe 50 yards away, going through the gate towards the woods. It was definitely Mandy. I'm not sure what she was wearing, and I couldn't say whether she was carrying anything. I wondered where she was going. I started to think about it. I thought she might have a problem, so I got dressed and decided to go out and join her. I know people in this trade do sometimes get pissed off and just want to talk. It took me a few minutes to get dressed. I went down the fire escape and out through the gate into the woods. I walked towards the lake, and I saw Mandy walking back from the direction of the lake. She said, 'What are you doing out here?' She seemed okay to me as far as I could ascertain. She was fully dressed, but for the life of me, I can't say what she was wearing. She basically said she was pissed off with everything and everybody. She didn't specify. I sat down with her on a seat facing the lake, and we just spoke in general about my girlfriend and the band I play with and other things. We talked about the mist rising off the water. I didn't suspect anything was particularly wrong. She seemed to be her normal self. The only unusual thing she said was, 'I've come on tonight and I've had blood clots.' I never pursued the point, but it seemed a funny thing for her to say to me. We must have talked for about 45 minutes, and I never suspected anything. I never thought any more about the baby I'd heard crying. We went back to the hotel and she came into my room for a cigarette, then she left. I never noticed anything unusual about her at all. I then went back to bed and had a sleep. Later that day, the staff remarked to each other that Mandy looked slimmer, and the next afternoon there was a commotion. According to the barman's statement, I was working in the bar when a woman came in asking for the phone. She had a dog with her. A bit later, another member of staff came in, Roger, and he said, the old biller over by the lake, a baby's been found. When he said this, I really came over ill. I remembered hearing this baby cry the previous morning and seeing Mandy by the lake, and I suddenly thought it all fitted. I didn't know what to do. I said to Roger, I know who it is. He said, Mandy? And I said, yes. That is fairly convincing evidence from a witness that the baby had lived, and perhaps lived for a good few minutes, if the mother had time to give birth in the hotel toilet. Evidence of this was soon found, and then get dressed and walk out of the hotel with her crying baby to dispose of it. And that fitted with the pathological evidence from the lungs that the baby had lived after birth. But could we say for sure that she had killed her baby, and if so, how? This was an upsetting case for everyone, not least because of the cool way the mother had given birth, disposed of her daughter, stillborn or not, and then returned to work that day pretending nothing was wrong. Today, she might be regarded as a tragic figure. 30 years ago, many of those involved in the case saw her as an unnatural, calculating baby killer. She showed no remorse, saying the baby had been born dead, and she showed no sadness either. The police and Crown Prosecution Service remained adamant that the charge should be murder. I was very confident from all the evidence that the baby had lived, but then how had she died? I could not find evidence on the child's body of violence or trauma, and no incontrovertible indication of asphyxiation. A very detailed laboratory analysis of the stomach confirmed the baby had taken in water from the lake, but not enough to indicate drowning. It could have got there passively, by non-sinister means. I gave as cause of death 1A, lack of care. The Crown Prosecution Service pressed ahead with its murder charge, but they were dismayed by my findings. They wanted me to say that the mother had taken more active steps to end the child's life. On the other hand, my report delighted the defence solicitor, who wrote to the CPS. We would invite you to consider whether the charge of murder should now be withdrawn, bearing in mind the apparent lack of an alleged act on the part of our client, which led to the death of the baby. Your pathologist says that death was caused shortly after birth due to an omission on the part of our client. Clearly a charge of murder would not therefore be appropriate. Indeed, we invite you to consider that a charge of manslaughter, i.e. infanticide, would not succeed, as you would not be able to show that the death of the baby was the result of a grossly negligent omission. Simple lack of care is not enough to prove this charge. Our client told the police how she laid the baby down and rocked it but thought that it was dead. It is true that the Crown Prosecution Service, for a murder case, had to prove a willful act of omission, that is, the deliberate failure to provide normal care at birth, such as cutting the cord and keeping the baby warm and fed. It is very hard, in the case of a frightened, inexperienced teenage girl, to prove that not doing these things is willful. In fact, Mandy was not a teenager, and she was not inexperienced, as we were to find out, but, for a while at least, the prosecutors were miserable. I am particularly concerned, their letter to me began, regarding the vague nature of your report. I am not medically trained, but I have a medical dictionary, and these are some of the points which have occurred to me. She listed 6 detailed points about the baby's death. Medical dictionaries were the scourge of doctors then, as the internet is now. Sometimes I wonder why I bothered with 16 years of training when all I needed to do was buy a medical dictionary or learn how to Google. But if a dictionary gave that lawyer a way into my work, then let her consult it. I'm only too happy to enlarge on my findings and rarely am given a chance to discuss a case. In response to these written questions from the CPS, I made a further statement, giving detailed answers to each of her points to show that most of her concerns, like meconium, were routinely found in newborns and none of them meant the baby had necessarily been asphyxiated. I stuck to my view that lack of care had caused the child's death. Although the mother might have actively killed the child, I couldn't prove it. The CPS were not at all satisfied. At a case conference with counsel, I was put under great pressure to step closer to the prosecution's case than the pathology of the child really allowed. I did not give in. Afterwards, I sent further notes answering points they had raised. It is not possible to define exactly the passage of time necessary to cause suffocation by blocking the airways. However, in a newborn baby, the minimum time is unlikely to be more than 15 to 30 seconds. There were no injuries to the mouth or nose to positively confirm that pressure had been applied to those areas. However, such injuries are not always present in cases of suffocation. Their absence, while preventing a positive conclusion, is not completely inconsistent with suffocation having occurred. I have given the survival period of less than 15 minutes. I think it is unlikely that the period of survival was as short as 1 or 2 minutes, only because the changes in the lungs are well established. I think it unlikely, or very unlikely, that the single breath would have resulted in the degree of changes I noted in the lungs. It is certainly the common event that a child will cry after birth, but, like all things in medicine, it is not absolute, and there is individual variation. The act of crying most certainly assists in the expansion of the lungs. It is not possible from my examination of the baby to make any specific comment concerning the well-being of the mother. There are, however, no features present on the child to suggest that this may have been an unusually difficult or traumatic delivery. It is very difficult to define lack of care. In my opinion, minimum care of a child immediately after birth is to wrap it in some sort of material to prevent the baby from cooling. Any other form of care may need previous experience rather than professional training. The minimum care of placing a child in a towel will, very markedly, at least reduce the risk of hypothermia. Hypothermia could have caused the death of this child within 50 minutes. A child has a very large surface area from which to lose heat, and this surface area would have been wet as a result of fluid from delivery, once again increasing heat loss. The cooler the environment in which the child lies, the greater the heat loss. The pathological features of a huge number of possible reasons for the child's death, including hypothermia, drowning, and asphyxiation, may not be present in a child when one would expect them to be in an adult. I cannot exclude or confirm any of them. The disappointed prosecution still pressed ahead, reluctantly conceding to the lesser charge of infanticide. They also threw in that ancient but rarely brought charge, concealment of a baby. Mandy was tried at the Old Bailey. Prosecuting counsel was quoted in newspaper reports telling the jury, "When she became pregnant, she decided to conceal her pregnancy and the existence of the baby once it was born. She followed the plan through to its logical conclusion by leaving and allowing or causing the child to die and disposing of the body by tying it in a black refuse bag. She continued to lie after birth by joining in with the general disapproval expressed when the body was found." The court was then told that Mandy had initially claimed the pregnancy was a result of a rape, but then changed her story. In fact, she had given birth before, on her mother's lavatory 2 years previously, when the child had been offered for adoption. A second unwanted pregnancy soon afterwards was terminated. The jury found her guilty of infanticide. The judge thundered, "You and only you had responsibility for that young child and you failed her." But he added, "It is clear that you were not, at that time, entirely responsible for what you did." She was sentenced to 2 years on probation and ordered to undergo 1 year of psychiatric treatment. There was a sense of disappointment in the prosecuting team, as everyone knew her sentence would have been harsher if she had been found guilty of murder. For myself, I had no regrets. It would have been unbearable if she had been tried for murder on the basis of evidence produced under pressure, but against my conscience. Chapter 14. Soon afterwards, I found myself learning more about truth, although I was now in a very different situation. The prosecution team and I were entirely in accord over this case, and by the time we were in court, we all felt confident that we had uncovered the truth. It was another Sunday morning call-out. More guilt, as Jen had to put aside her work to care for the children, meaning she would have to study through the night to make up for lost time. Jen must have asked herself why the dead seemed so much more important in our house than the living, and looking back, I don't blame her. The children were older now and a little more independent, but conflicting demands were causing frequent clashes between their parents. However, our division of labour was clear-cut to me. As the breadwinner, my work had to take priority. Only now can I see from Jen's point of view how frustrating this must have been and how much I must have infuriated her. After all, she wasn't studying for studying's sake, but so that one day she would be a doctor and a joint contributor to household income. I entirely failed to appreciate that. I was so work-immersed and so focused on how to make our hectic lives functional that I couldn't, or wouldn't, understand her dissatisfaction. I set off that sunny morning towards central London, feeling more excited than guilty. I adored my children, and a Sunday spent looking after them would be many things. Fun, demanding, tiring, fulfilling. But, and this now seems perverse and scarcely believable to me, those pleasures could not compete with the possible intellectual engagement of an interesting post-mortem. Yes, even though I was already a few years into the job, I still could not contain my excitement at each new case that came my way. The stardust that the pages of Keith Simpson's book had sprinkled in my young eyes so long ago was still there. Let other hearts sink on nearing Westminster Mortuary. Mine beat faster as I thought of the situation, the story, the puzzle of the body awaiting me. And this was despite the fact that I knew the chances were, on a Sunday morning, that I'd be dealing yet again with the consequences of another Saturday night pub brawl. Westminster Mortuary is hidden behind the Coroner's Court in Horseferry Road in central London, but these are not among that area's famous buildings. In fact, tourists heading towards the Tate hardly notice the beautiful old red brick court on the corner, and they are completely unaware of the mortuary behind it. Like so many institutions of death, it is discreet enough to oblige those who don't wish to be reminded of the inevitable. In fact, the mortuary had then not long been rebuilt and was the most modern in the UK. Its public entrance was glassy, its lighting was bright, its offices spick and span, and its areas for grieving relatives elegantly painted in pastel shades. But despite all that glass and newness, arriving here on a weekend marked a transition, from family life back across the taboo into a darker world where, albeit with jolly staff and warm rooms, death is a way of life. The smell of the mortuary, death's perfume in my nostrils, I greeted the small crowd waiting for me, the mortuary staff, a socco, scenes of crime officer, a young police constable and two detectives. There was also a police photographer who seemed often to be on call when I was, and who was becoming a familiar face. The kettle on, we went into the tiny staff tea room. It was empty on a Sunday. Detective Inspector Fox spoke first. "Now then, the deceased is a young bloke. Saturday night, a lot of booze, bit of cannabis. So it was a typical Sunday morning job after all. My heart sank. I'd rather be at home with the kids. Had a bit of a run-in with, not the first time I'd heard this one either, a knife, bottle, fist, his girlfriend and..." "She'd knifed him then, almost certainly." The detective hesitated. "And so she strangled him." I stared at him. That was not the ending I'd expected. Female stranglers are extremely rare, almost non-existent. Looking back now, tens of thousands of postmortems later, I believe there is no other female strangler in my files. "Has she confessed?" I asked. "Turned up outside the police station in the middle of the night with blood, scratches, shirt torn, crying her eyes out. We called an ambulance. She said she'd had a fight with a boyfriend and thought she'd hurt him." "How long before?" "Apparently only minutes. We rushed over there, no pulse, did everything we could, got him in the ambulance and kept trying, but it was no good. When we told her he was dead, she was, well, it was terrible." He looked upset. He'd obviously been in the Met a long time, and I wondered why this case was affecting him so much. "I was interviewing her for hours and she never changed her story. Self-defense and, well, she's a sweet young thing." His colleague agreed. "Yeah, Teresa Lazenby her name is. Nice little face, in tears most of the time." The detective inspector nodded. "Seems such a good kid, it's hard to believe she could have... But he was trying to kill her, and she had to save her own skin. I know how the living send out signals which are designed to appeal to our hearts. I know how easily I personally respond to these signals." The girlfriend's remorse had clearly rubbed off on the detectives, and although she had confessed to a terrible crime, she had somehow won their sympathy. I felt relieved then that the dead can send out no such subtle appeals to our emotions. They can only tell the unadorned truth. The mortuary assistant handed me a cup of tea, and I threw it back and went to the lockers to put on my scrubs, apron and mortuary wellies. As we made our way from the public area to the busy, functional working area, the clangs and clatters of the trolleys grew loud and the smell increased. I glanced at the men around me. For the Socco, this was routine, and the detectives had seen it all before and were nonchalant, or at least keen to appear nonchalant. However, as we passed the bank of fridges and line of trolleys waiting by them, I could see that the young police officer was nervous. PC Northern had not eaten the biscuit the staff had given him with his tea, and now his face was pale and hollow. Just before we went through the footbath, into the room where forensic postmortems take place, he blurted out, "It's my first PM." By now, my management of onlookers was improving. I could not forget my failure to alleviate the misery of the police officer at that first postmortem. It seemed to me that he had picked up my tension, and this had greatly added to his distress. Since then, I had worked hard to appear relaxed. I remembered the Michael Ross postmortem, where a superintendent had barely been able to control himself in front of very junior staff. After that, I determined that when I performed a postmortem, no one should ever leave the mortuary traumatized. My only weapon was communication. "When we look at a dead body," I told PC Northern, "we never forget that they were a person once, that there are grieving relatives, that the deceased and their family deserve respect. We're going to help all of them today by trying to find out exactly what happened. We're looking for evidence. We want to help the dead man tell us his story. It's important for all the grieving people that we put aside our own feelings and do a good job for them. So, without uttering a word, the body we're examining today will be our witness and our teacher." PC Northern nodded glumly. I used the kindest, most reassuring tone I could muster. "Don't worry, I'll talk you through it. It won't be nearly as bad as you think if I explain what I'm doing." The worldly wise detective sergeant said, "You get used to it." The detective inspector was determined to be macho. "Listen, the people in the fridges here are gone, not at home, lad. Just pull yourself together." We stepped into the brightly lit room where the body was lying naked, wrapped in a plastic sheet on a metal table. "He's been ID'd," said the Socco as I opened the sheet. "What's his name?" He knew the name, but he passed the question to the young policeman, who was glad to stop staring at the body and shuffled busily through his notes. Anthony Pearson, aged, 22. Anthony Pearson had a mop of blonde hair and well-defined features. His eyes were shut. The dead usually looked peaceful and without facial expression. Was there a hint of anger about him? Not because he had necessarily died angry, but because, out of habit or bad luck, his features fell that way. I thought then that he was mildly obese, but norms have changed so much that today I would simply describe him as stocky. There were large tattoos as well as bruises on both arms, and old scars across his wrists that hinted at a troubled life. The much more recent incisions, defined by lines of blood running across his forearms, confirmed it. Defibrillation marks on his chest were evidence of the resuscitation attempts the officer had described. Most noticeable of all was his neck. Beneath it, the hospital sheet was heavily bloodstained. Across it was a thick, ragged line of blood that had dried after trickling from the side of his mouth. I nodded to the police photographer, paparazzo to the dead. He lifted his large camera and organized the correct sighting of the two large flash guns, the sort often seen outside film premieres. Snap, flash. "Okay, that's the whole body, Doc. Close up to the neck now, please," I said. I was already taking notes on my pro forma sheets. The ligature mark is a vital piece of evidence, and of course it can indicate the type of material used. If the ligature is wire, electric cable, string or thin cord, then the mark is clear-cut and deep with sharply defined edges. But this mark was highly irregular, ragged even. She must have used something soft. Fabric? Perhaps a scarf? For the photographer's next shot, I rapidly placed a ruler across Anthony's throat so that the photos would confirm the measurements in my report. Snap, flash. I made a note. Contused and abraded irregular ligature mark across the front of the neck, extending from the right angle of the jaw to 2 centimeters lateral to the left angle of the jaw, level with Adam's apple, deepest bruising either side of Adam's apple. I checked very carefully all around the neck wound for other relevant marks. I'd seen cases of strangulation where the line of the ligature was surrounded by scratches or bruises, indicating either that the victim was trying to pull the ligature off, or where the ligature mark overlay groups of bruises, that the assailant had attempted manual strangulation before grabbing the ligature. But there was nothing like that here. She said she used his tie, the detective sergeant told me. The inspector shook his head. He had said it before, and he said it again. She's only a little slip of a thing. Tiny little girl, agreed the detective sergeant. I suppose if your life's in danger, you somehow find the strength. I documented in detail the scarring of the wrists, the scratch marks on the back of the left arm, and the defibrillation marks, measuring them and defining their location. We'll have the tattoos and the wrist, please, I told the photographer. He took close-ups of the graphically illustrated tattoos. The cartoon character Top Cat, and on the right upper arm, love, below it in larger letters, was hate. Since a relative had already identified Anthony, we didn't need the tattoos for that purpose, but routinely photographed them anyway. In those days before DNA evidence was used, many a body was identified by tattoos, particularly if early decomposition defied other means. Although the ligature mark was so significant, I now checked for other indications to confirm Anthony had been asphyxiated. The first telltale sign was the redness of the skin on his face, caused by the obstruction of the thin and easily compressed veins in the neck. The arteries serving the brain are much wider and more resilient to pressure, and so blood can still enter the head through them, but because the veins are obstructed during asphyxiation, it cannot return to the heart. However, the main indicator, whether asphyxiation is a result of choking, suffocation, strangling, or some other cause, is found in and around the eyes. Many, or even most people, develop multiple tiny pinpoints of blood on the conjunctivae, the inner lining of the eyelids, when asphyxiated. These are called petechial hemorrhages. Similar pinpoint hemorrhages can also develop, rarely when someone coughs or sneezes violently. They're less common in suffocation, but almost everyone dying of strangulation will show them, as did Anthony. I held his eyes wide open with forceps so that the photographer could see them. Snap, flash. I measured Anthony's height, 5'11", and then turned him over so that his back could be photographed. There was a gasp from PC Northern. I felt ashamed for a moment that I'd forgotten him and my intention to steer him through this, but then I hadn't made a single cut yet. When I looked up, I saw he was staring at Anthony in horror. Oh my God, she beat him black and blue. I shook my head. No, no, that coloration is just one of the normal processes of death. He stared at me uncertainly. It's called hypostasis. Some people call it lividity. I know it looks like bruising, and it can be really alarming the first time you see it, but it's absolutely normal. I explained in some detail the science of hypostasis, how it is gravity's pull over the red blood cells after death, which creates such shocking purple areas. I also pointed out how forensically valuable it can be, since the laws of gravity dictate that the staining always shows at the lowest point. It reveals the position the body has lain in after death. But if the body has been moved to a different position, then an overlapping pattern, like a shadow, will tell the story. Hypostasis can be misleading, though. Somebody dying face down, nose pressed into a blanket, will have a livid face with blanching around the nose and mouth. Normal hypostasis. It is too easy to assume from this that suffocation has taken place, and I've known many a pathologist fall into this trap. Now that Anthony lay on his front, I could minutely examine his neck below the hairline. There was no sign of any ligature mark here. Nothing. I called the photographer over to record this, and then turned Anthony over again. Here was the mark, right across his throat, and only his throat. Since I hadn't made a cut yet, PC Northern might have been hoping that by some miracle I wouldn't need to. He'd been sufficiently interested in hypostasis to relax, or almost. Then I picked up my trusty PM40, large and heavy. Through my earliest years of performing postmortems on sudden natural deaths, there had only been its little cousin, the scalpel. As I moved into forensics, the PM40, a knife specifically designed for postmortems with bigger, removable blades, had begun to dominate, and by now it had long been every pathologist's best friend. Its handle slipped easily into my palm. Its weight felt reassuringly familiar.